Hello and welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Amy Beecham and I'm the marketing director here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is utilizing qualified income trusts hosted by our legal education director, Jim Wolverton. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, you can go ahead and type those into the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar and we will answer them at the end of our presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint, along with several other handouts, will be available from a Dropbox link that I will provide attendees in the chat section of GoToWebinar Toolbar. If anyone has any questions on accessing those files, you can reach out to marketing@krausfinancial.com and we will set you up. And then finally, we also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of today's presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now we will get on to today's content. And Jim, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Amy. It is a pleasure to be here. When we were talking about this topic, I questioned whether or not we could come up with enough content to cover, and then I created 50 something slides. So we have a lot to cover here today. I am actually really excited to talk about qualified income trusts. What I did want to say was something that's really cool about Kraus. We had an all hands meeting, and we have 30 plus experience in Medicaid planning, but those 40 professionals on staff, we did it. There was all these little boxes, and everyone, I was just blown away by the professionalism, the experience, just a great, great company to work with and work for. And you can see there the Medicaid compliant annuity doing 400 plus cases a month. You can imagine our planners have seen everything and love working with attorneys to help you and your clients with long-term care planning. So what I was saying before is we have a lot to cover, and now we're even a little bit more delayed. So fortunately, I like to talk fast, so we should be able to get through everything. So today's goals for this webinar is to provide an introduction to the Medicaid program and its requirements before we can really understand where the qualified income trust plays into Medicaid planning. We need to get some context to put those in. And then, like I was saying earlier, before I froze up, when I was learning the Medicaid planning techniques that we'll talk about today, this particular step always threw me, and I never really understood why it existed. And I was talking to a friend of mine, Steve Dale, who teaches a lot of special needs planning. And if you have ever done any special needs planning, there's a lot of really weird rules in there. And what he always said is, look to the history of how this planning evolved, and it'll help you make sense of why some of these rules are the way that they are. So we're going to do that. We're going to take a step back and really look at that Miller case. And what did it say? Some people refer to these types of trusts as Miller trusts, and that comes out of that Miller v. Ibarra case, out of a case here in Colorado where I live. And we'll chat about that and get into that a little bit. And then we'll define what are the elements of a qualified income trust. What makes that trust work for Medicaid planning? And then we'll talk a little bit about practical aspects of implementing these trusts for your clients if you do live in a state that requires them. But before we can run, we have to walk. So let's talk a little bit about Medicaid planning. Medicaid for long-term care is a joint federal and state funded program meant for those with limited means that need help with their long-term care costs. What we're talking about generally is folks in a nursing home that need that level of care. One thing that you'll learn about Medicaid planning if you're new to this practice area is the program varies state to state. There's federal rules, but then the federal rules allow the states to select how they want to manage their own Medicaid program. And one of the key components, and this is where elder law attorneys that do crisis Medicaid planning come into play, is there are both non-financial and financial criteria to qualify to get help to pay that nursing home bill. The nursing home bills can range anywhere from $6,000 a month all the way up, I've seen up to $20,000 a month. So how are you going to pay for that is using either private money or Medicaid funds, and that's where Medicaid planning comes in, is to get some help to help supplement that cost for folks. So let's review some of the non-financial requirements. These generally aren't that exciting and don't really provide a lot of planning opportunities, but generally, the client needs to reside in a Medicaid-approved facility. And again, this is generally a nursing home. There's some waiver programs in states that do allow some funding for less than nursing home level of care. But what we're going to talk about here today are the rules around nursing home level of care. And this is a really important topic to talk about, just how practical element of this is getting to know in your community which facilities do receive Medicaid funds. And so going out in your community, visiting those facilities, getting to know the professionals that work there can be a really boon to your practice. And it also helps you create and provide better counseling to your clients when they're talking about where they want to receive that care. You'll have an insight into that, and always a good networking opportunity as well to get to know the folks that run those facilities. Other non-financial requirement is U.S. citizen or qualified alien, and then 65 or older, blind or disabled. So those are the non-financial requirements. Again, not generally too exciting. When we get into the financial requirements, this is where a elder law attorney can really help a client accelerate their eligibility, but we have to understand what those requirements are. When I was learning Medicaid planning, one of the most insightful things someone told me is when you're thinking about people's stuff, divide it into two, get a piece of paper, and they actually got a piece of paper out, drew a line down the middle of it, and said, there's rules for assets and there's rules for income. What we're going to talk about here are the asset rules, then we'll talk about the income rules. But the asset rules, you need to understand those, because when we're doing crisis Medicaid program or Medicaid planning, what we're doing is we're taking things from the asset side of the ledger and removing them over to the income side. So we need to understand both before we can really hop into the meat of these trusts. So an institutionalized individual in most states is allowed to keep only $2,000 in countable assets. There are some states that have higher amounts and there are states that have lower amounts there. So you want to log on to Attorney Access on the Crouse Financial website and then print out your desk reference guide. Print that out and you'll see all those numbers are there. Illinois does have, they just recently imposed a higher individual resource amount. New York has had traditionally a higher one. And then the wild card out there is California. They are removing all sort of asset requirements at the beginning of next year. So January 1st, 2024. This requirement will be altogether gone in California. So we'll see what happens with that. A lot of exciting chatter about what's gonna happen with the California removes that. So that's the institutionalized individual, usually about $2,000 of assets. The community spouse, the spouse that's not in a facility, they're allowed to keep a separate amount. And that's referred to as a community spouse resource allowance. As you get into Medicaid planning, it's just full of acronyms and weird terms, and this is one of them. So this is called the CISRA. When you're talking to other attorneys, I wouldn't say that with your clients, but that's what other attorneys refer to this at. So like I mentioned earlier, states are allowed to manage their own programs. And this is one of those areas where they can choose how they want to designate a community spouse resource amount. In what we call standard states, it's just a number, and the community spouse resource amount right now in 2023 is $148,620, and that number changes each year. If you look at your numbers on Attorney Access and you see two numbers, we call that a minimum and a maximum state. And what that means is a community spouse is allowed to retain one half of their countable assets as of the snapshot date. So there's a lot of a vocabulary in that sentence. So we'll talk about what countable assets are, but the snapshot date is the day that an institutionalized individual enters into care on a continuous basis. So that may or may not be the application date. It may be a year or 2 years prior if they haven't made a Medicaid application yet. So you do have to look back and figure out what the snapshot date is if that's what your state requires. But generally, it's half of what they have so long as it falls between the minimum number, 29,724, and cannot exceed the maximum number, which is generally, or right now, it's 148,620. So you take half, so really easy math, because I'm not good at math, we will do $200,000. If the community spouse has $200,000, you split that in half, that's $100,000, that falls between the range. Their community spouse resource allowance would be $100,000. You have to help them figure out what to do with that extra $100,000. And that's really where crisis Medicaid planning comes into play. Okay, so what is a countable resource? Let's start on the right-hand side of this slide. So what is accountable resource? Basically anything the client can liquidate and pay for their own care. Things like checking, savings, money market accounts, stocks, bonds. In most states, IRAs are accountable resource unless the state excludes those. And then any other toys that the client has, other vehicles, second properties, you know, second homes, lake homes, RVs, snowmobiles, whatever their toys are, those will be countable resources. However, there are some exempt resources that don't count towards their allowance. So the most important one for most people is their primary residence, so long as they have an intent to return home. Generally, the individual can keep one vehicle, their personal property. They don't have to go through and take an inventory of everything in their home, and then an irrevocable funeral expense trust to pay for the cost of their funeral when they do pass away. So those are some exempt resources, and then everything else generally is accountable resource. So those are the assets that we have to deal with. So if the clients have over that amount, we have to do some crisis planning. Now we're going to talk about income. So now we're going to the other side of the piece of paper, and we're thinking about the rules around income. The institutionalized individual cannot have income ever that exceeds the private pay rate. So that doesn't matter if you're in an income cap state or not. That's just a general rule. Income can never go over the private pay rate of the facility, because if you have that much income, Medicaid says, well, you can pay for yourself to stay in that facility. The community spouse, and this is if you're new to this type of planning, this first sentence is really, really important, is there are no limits on the income of the community spouse. So there is no roof or ceiling, as some people say, to how much income the community spouse can have. However, there is a floor. So the rules state that we don't want to impoverish the community spouse. So the way that this works is they might be able to receive some of the institutionalized individual's income so that they don't become impoverished. And the way that I like to think about this is I always like to use my own personal references so I can remember this, is my grandparents on my mom's side, my grandmother never worked, but my grandfather did, and he taught school for a very long time and had a pension. If he were to use all of his money to pay for his nursing home, she wouldn't have any money to pay her bills for the water, for the heat, because she didn't have a source of income. So what we're allowed to do in Medicaid planning is move some of the monthly income to which the community spouse is entitled. And one thing that we didn't have on the previous slide that is really a really important concept with income is the income of the institutionalized individual is going to go to the nursing home to help pay their share of cost in that nursing home, minus a few exceptions. And this happens to be one of these exceptions. It's called the monthly maintenance needs allowance, or it's referred to as a MIMNA. When you're at a cocktail party with elder law attorneys, you'll hear them say that. So if the community spouse's income is below this amount, they're entitled to a shift of income from the institutionalized spouse dollar for dollar until that allowance is met. Some states, again, this is where states can vary, they'll just have one number and the community spouse is entitled to, and that number, again, these numbers all change each year. So definitely subscribe to Attorney Access and we'll let you know when they change. Right now, that number is $3,715.50. So if the community spouse doesn't have that much income, we're going to shift income from the institutionalized spouse over to the community spouse. Other states, you'll see two numbers. If you have a minimum and a maximum amount, the community spouse is always entitled to the minimum, which is currently $2,465 in most states, but they could be entitled to a larger amount, not to exceed that maximum number, which just gets into all sorts of acronyms. It's the maximum MIMNA of $3,715.50. And the way that you do this is you calculate it using a standard utility allowance and a shelter standard. And we'll run through this pretty quickly. But basically what that standard utility allowance is, Medicaid has said, I don't want you to bring in all your utility bills. We're just going to use a number for a utility allowance. And that figure generally varies from state to state. You can see Arizona is $325 and Wisconsin is $471. So again, go to Attorney Access, look up your numbers, and you'll see that. The shelter standard basically is what Medicaid says that the community spouse is required, the kind of their requirement, what they have to pay. Their shelter expenses is what they are responsible for. So right now, in most states, that's a standard number of $740 in most states. And so their MIMNA their allowance is increased dollar for dollar from the minimum, not to exceed the maximum over that amount. So now we're going to get into the fun stuff. So when we're talking about income, how much income can a institutionalized person have? Like I mentioned earlier, the universal rule is they can't have over the private pay rate, but some states have also said, we're going to put an income cap on how much income the institutionalized individual can have. And this number generally represents 300% of the current federal benefit rate, which is $2,742 this year. So if you're in an income cap state, that number, 2,742, unless you're in Delaware, is going to be the income cap. Delaware has a lower number. And if the applicant's income exceeds this amount and you're in an income cap state, this is where these qualified income trusts come in. If the income of the institutionalized individual is over $2,742, then you have to create what's called a qualified income trust. And again, you'll hear practitioners refer to these as Miller trusts as well. So what states have income caps? The shaded states, I believe. Yeah, we are shaded here. So if you're in one of these shaded states, keep listening. If you're not, I hope you enjoyed that primer on Medicaid planning. You don't need to listen to this presentation unless you just want to learn more about qualified income trusts, because these states are the states that require that you establish a qualified income trust for your clients to qualify for Medicaid should their income exceed that $2,742 amount. So what the heck is a qualified income trust? A qualified income trust is an irrevocable income-only trust that is established solely for the purpose of Medicaid eligibility in income cap states. And this will allow an individual with income above that cap to still qualify for Medicaid benefits. So that's the basic definition of what a qualified income trust is and who needs to create one. So where the heck did this come from, and why do you have to have a specific trust for this amount over the income cap? That's where the history of this case comes from, and hopefully this will start making a little bit of sense once we get into this. So the qualified income trust came out of a case out of here in Colorado. There were four individuals that needed a conservatorship because they couldn't make their own decisions and they really needed nursing home level care. And so what this case did is it looked at what can someone do that has income above that income cap, because prior to this case, if you had over that income cap, but you couldn't pay the private pay rate in the facility. So we didn't want to just throw these people out. They were getting threatened with eviction. They were otherwise deserving applicants. They didn't have any other options but to completely deplete their assets, which they did, but they didn't have enough income to pay that rent every single month. So that's what happened in this Miller v. Ibarra case that we'll take a dive into. Again, this comes out of Colorado. There were four women here that were denied Medicaid benefits because their income was above that income cap. This case came out in 1991, I believe. Let me just look really quick. 1990. So this was under the rules of Medicaid in 1990, and some of those rules have changed, and we'll talk about that as well. So we have these women that had different ailments. These folks were in really bad condition. They had Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, heart failure, multiple sclerosis, and other medical issues. They were in conservatorship. Each woman required a really high level of care due to their limitations, due to their conditions. These were people that really, really needed help paying for their nursing home care. And they were just in a situation that was really unwinnable. They were stuck. They didn't know what to do because they had this problem where they had income over the income cap, but they didn't have enough to pay the private pay rate in the nursing home. And what they called this back then was called the Utah gap. So if you really want to impress people at a dinner party, you can say, oh yeah, there was a situation and that person's in the Utah gap. I've never heard anyone say that, so you could really impress your friends there. So that comes out of this case, and that's the situation that they were in. And because they were under conservatorship, the court said, and I don't know where this came from, but the court created a trust to hold their income and basically said the trustee has discretion to make distributions out of this trust, but it has to fall under the situation where they're supplementing their care, but not supplanting their benefits. And this was just their income was going to go into this amount. And again, it was over the income cap, but not enough to pay the private pay rate. And then it would be distributed to pay their nursing home bill, but they couldn't use it for anything else. The court set this up, all the income's flowing through there. They reapply, and Medicaid here in Colorado, if those of you that have ever heard of the Colorado Medicaid office, they're very sweet and they really like to help people. That is very sarcastic because they fight everything and they still deny their benefits. So these women are facing eviction. They're being threatened to get thrown out of these nursing homes. Janet Miller is the representative for the lead plaintiff. That's where you get this Miller Trust terminology, if you do hear that. You can see some of the language here that talks about this Utah gap or this catch 22 in healthcare policy. And the highlighted part is really what comes out here is we have a situation where the incomes are too low to enable them to pay for their own nursing home costs, but they're too high to qualify for Medicaid benefits because they're above the income cap. These claimants are ensnared in a trap created by the intersection of technical federal and state statutes and regulations. They're not allowed to pay as much as they can and then have Medicaid pay the balance. Instead, they're totally disqualified from any Medicaid assistance. So the judge has these folks in front of them that need their help, and the conservator judge has created this trust for them. So the issues in this case, and we did provide a link, or we actually, I did an actual printout, a PDF of the Miller Trust case. So definitely take a look and read this. And remember, again, the rules are from 1990 and they've changed since then. But the issues that were before the judge is, should income placed in that trust be considered available for Medicaid purposes? Because availability is a really important term when you come to Medicaid planning. Because remember, when we were talking about resources, anything you can liquidate and pay for your own funds, that's an available resource. So is the income placed in the trust considered available for Medicaid purposes? And does the creation of that trust constitute an improper transfer of assets? So we didn't talk about that, but in Medicaid planning, you can't just give away your stuff and then qualify for Medicaid immediately. Rather, you have to get fair market value for anything that you purchase. So moving your income into this trust, is that an improper transfer of assets, is what the court had to look at. So the court looks at the availability issue and should that income be available for Medicaid purposes. What the court does is it looks at federal and state eligibility requirements, and we have to look and see whether or not that they have ownership right to those funds. Obviously, the plaintiffs say, no, these trusts, they don't have any ownership rights in them. The trustees own that. However, the defendants, they don't really get into this. The state doesn't really talk about availability. They're just saying that this is a transfer for less than fair market value. So the court goes and looks at the POMS. That's the Program Operation Manual System for Social Security, and they look there, and what does it say about trust? And basically what the POMS say about trust is that the principle of a trust is not a resource to the claimant if their access to that principle is restricted. And then they look even further into the Colorado trust regs, which explain that if a claimant has the right to use the property in a trust, as well as authority to dispose of that right, the property is considered an available resource. So then we look at the trust, and the trusts say that for purposes of determining Medicaid eligibility, in the maximum amount of discretion, the trustees of that trust can distribute, but not back to the plaintiffs. So basically what those trusts say is those assets could only be distributed for their medical needs. And so they don't have the right or the ownership of those funds any longer, because the trustees in the trust language that the judge created under that conservatorship says this money can only be used for their medical needs. Okay, so that money is not available to the plaintiffs. What do we look at now? Is this an improper transfer of assets into this trust just to qualify for Medicaid? In the analysis, the court looks at the congressional intent of the transfer rules, which now are found in 42 USC 1396P. I don't know where they were in 1990. They may have been there as well. But basically, they look at the legislative intent, and it says that one purpose evident in the federal and state Medicaid laws, like their counterparts in the Aid to Families with Dependent Children, is to prevent abuse of the Medicaid system. For example, federal and state law provides for periods of ineligibility when individuals attempt to become eligible for Medicaid benefits by disposing of assets. So is that what is happening here? That's what the state said. They said that the creation of these trusts constitutes a transfer for less than fair market value because the purpose was to obtain Medicaid eligibility. The transfer to those trusts was done without any consideration, and they're intended to create fictional barriers so people can get on Medicaid. And I'm going to put words in the mouth of the state attorney there, to create fictional barriers so people can get the help they need that they're entitled to. So plaintiffs counter that and say, regardless of the availability discussion, which the court ruled in their favor on, the transfer rules don't apply because these transfers were not voluntary. It was created by a court with folks under a conservatorship. The creation of the trust was not a transfer, and the transfer rules that are in place were intended to prevent a transfer of resources or principal, and they don't apply to income. So the court looks at those arguments and they agree that the transfers were not voluntary because a probate court must first establish incompetency to establish the conservatorship before ordering the creation of one of these trusts, and that the transfer is not one that would be imputed to the plaintiff because it was not a voluntary transfer, and that the payments placed in this trust for the plaintiffs were not resources, rather it was income, and therefore they weren't prohibited by 1396 PC as it was written in 1990. So at the end of the day, the court comes back and says that the income of folks that are mentally incompetent, that need nursing home care, which these women were, that were subject to judicially imposed trusts created pursuant to Colorado statute, because it was all under the rules of conservatorship in the probate court, could not be considered available to the patients for purposes of terminating their eligibility because under the terms of the trust, they couldn't use those funds for anything. The trustee couldn't use it for anything but their medical needs. And the acts of the court creating the trust in favor of these patients were not violations of the transfers for less than fair market value or transfers of the resources rules, because it was strictly limited to income that was being put in these trusts. So hopefully that helps shine a little bit of light of where the heck did this rule come from. And that's why you'll hear practitioners call qualified income trusts as Miller trusts, because of that court case. So that, again, that is in your materials. Take a look at that, read that case. It's a good case to really get the lay of the land on Medicaid planning and these qualified income trusts, kind of the history of where it came from. And you can really see that these women really needed that help, and then they're facing eviction, which is a really sad story. And the court came up with a favorable solution. So this happened in Colorado, and then the next thing that happens is there's some federal legislation that takes that case and puts it into the Medicaid qualification rules. And that happens in 1993. Again, if you're ever at a cocktail party with elder law attorneys, this is a term you'll hear them throw out, over 93. This was a big act when it came to Medicaid rules, because this was President Clinton, which is surprising for some that it was a Democratic president that put these rules in place. Basically, he was elected on the platform that he was going to tackle the national debt. And so how he did that was through this Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993, by increasing taxes and changing a lot of the Medicaid qualification rules to make it harder to qualify for Medicaid benefits. That was going to help him balance that budget. And so a lot of these new rules that came out about asset transfers, and then also carved out exemptions for certain trusts if they have specific limitations, I guess is probably the right term to use. And you'll find those in, and this is where they are today, 42 USC 1396 P D4B. So that's where the Miller Trust live, is in 1396 P D4B. If any of you have done any sort of special needs planning, you know that a first party special needs trust is referred to many times as a D4A trust. So this is in that same, and Brian Albee from Elder Council will get mad at me because I'll call it a subsection, even though it's a subsection. D4A is where you find those first party special needs trusts. You find the Miller Trust or the Qualified Income Trust in D4B, and then you'll find your pooled special needs trust in D4C. So this is where those exempt trusts live in the rules, which again, if you really want to impress your friends, you can bust that out at an elder law conference one day. So what does the federal statute say, and how did they codify this case out of Colorado? What it says, and we'll just read through these, is the trust is composed only of pension, Social Security, and other income of the individual and any accumulated income in the trust. So limited to income, no resources are going through this trust. And then this was a key component here, is the state will receive all amounts remaining in the trust upon the death of such individual up to an amount equal to the total medical assistance paid on behalf of the individual under the state Medicaid plan. And so what this says is there's a state payback provision in these trusts. So if there's any money left when the person passes away in this trust, that's going to go to the state to help recoup some of the costs that the state spent on their care. So that's what the rules state. And then HICFA Transmittal 64, this is another a big letter that came out after OBRA 93 that really explained kind of what these rules meant. And this is in that Transmittal Letter 64. Again, this is in your materials, and this is section 3259.7 subsection C that talks about Miller type or qualified income trust. So this puts a little bit more meat on the bone of what needs to be in these trusts. And so it states that the trust can only be composed of income to the individual, wherever the source comes from. No resources can be used to establish or augment the trust, and any resources that goes into this trust is voided. The trust has to be irrevocable. Income that's placed in that trust is not available and therefore not countable for Medicaid eligibility. Came right out of the Miller case. We know where that language is coming from. And then the transfer of asset penalties do not apply to income placed in the trust so long as it's paid out of the trust specifically for the medical care provided to the individual and will be considered a fair market purchase of that care. So that's how they got around this being a transfer for less than fair market value. So that's the federal level. And now the states have implemented this. If you look into your Medicaid manuals, if you're in an income cap state, you'll find the requirements. They're pretty much follow along with the federal rules pretty similarly. And this is one that I pulled from Kentucky. And you kind of see that they changed the language a little bit, but it's in there. So again, look to the federal rules first, and then look to the HICFA 64 for a little bit if it's a rule that came out of that OBRA 93. And then we look to our state Medicaid manual for the state requirements. So here we have the Kentucky rule that has the language here that says an individual may create a qualified income trust in accordance with the subsection to establish financial eligibility for Medicaid. And then it goes to why the transfer of resources does not apply. So this is not a penalized transfer so long as the trust is established in Kentucky for the benefit of the individual. The trust is composed solely of income for the individual, so no resources going in there. Upon the death of the individual, the department receives all amount remaining in the trust. Here's your payback provision, up to an amount equal to the total medical assistance paid on behalf of the individual by Medicaid, and the trust has to be irrevocable. So again, you can see that pretty closely mirrors the federal statute, the way that Kentucky wrote theirs. Subsection B of that talks a little bit about how the money in the qualified income trust is managed. It has to be maintained in a separate account and cannot be commingled with any other checking or savings account. So the trustee of this trust needs to go to the bank and establish a bank account that solely holds this income pursuant to the terms of the trust that comply with the rules. Subsection C states that the corpus of a qualified income trust and interest generated by the trust shall not be counted as available income for an individual for the determination of Medicaid eligibility. It's not theirs anymore. The trustee has to pay this money for their medical needs. Generally, when we're talking about our long-term care clients, that's going to the nursing home for their medical care. And then it talks about what these funds will be used for. This goes right into that. A qualified income trust shall state that the funds shall only be used for valid medical expenses, including patient liability at a nursing home, and the community spouse income allowance established in accordance with their statute. That's that MMNA qualification that we looked at. So the trustee can only make distributions for valid medical expenses, including patient liability, or that community spousal income allowance, which is the MMNA qualification that we looked at earlier, if we have to do a transfer from the institutionalized individual over to the community spouse, that is an allowed distribution out of this trust. And then all expenditures from a qualified income trust shall require verification by the department that expenditures are allowed expenditures. So there is an accounting, that is allowed should the Medicaid office want to do that for distributions out of this trust. So I thought it would be really helpful to look how Kentucky handled this. And again, it just adds in a little bit of context on how the states have implemented these federal rules. Okay. There's another slide in here. Sorry. About Kentucky, about how payments are made out of that has to be made every month. By the end of the month following the month, the funds are placed in the trust. So these need to be paid out every month. You can't have money just sitting in that trust. And if payment by the qualifying income trust are made for medical care, the individual shall be considered to have received fair market value for the income placed in the trust. Again, getting around any sort of penalty there. So that really lays out the rules around these trusts very well. I think Kentucky did a really good job here in writing their Medicaid manual just as a whole, but especially in this section to make it crystal clear how these trusts work and what needs to be in them. So hopefully your state's Medicaid manual is written as well as Kentucky, not all are. So that is, I thought, was a really good example of how states have implemented those federal requirements. Okay, so how do these work in practice? We look at the trust and we know that we have to have some certain provisions in there. The trusts have to be irrevocable. Again, they can only contain income of the institutionalized individual. No assets will go into this trust. A trustee has to be assigned to manage the administration, the creation of that, remember, that separate individual account, and the expenditures of the trust that can only be made for those two purposes that we looked at in Kentucky anyway. It states that it has to be made for their medical needs, or if we have a MMNA shift, then that would be an allowable expense as well. So you need somebody that's on top of it and can make these transfers each and every month. Then we have that payback provision that the state Medicaid agency be named as primary beneficiary of the trust up to the amount of benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So that's what needs to be in the document. So again, let's remember, when do we use qualified income trust? And this is a question that we get all the time, and I think can get really confusing if you stray from the rule. Just remember the rule that a QIT is required when the applicant's gross income exceeds the cap. So before we make any sort of deductions when determining whether a trust is needed, do not take into account the personal needs allowance, any potential shift under the MMNA rules, or other medical expenses that are deducted from their copay. And I advise all the time, plan conservatively. If you're an income cap state, if your client's income goes over $2,742 this year, establish the trust. It doesn't hurt. Plan conservatively. Just set that up. And when you apply for Medicaid, submit the trust documents, show that you have that done, and hopefully your clients will be otherwise eligible. But this is not a place, if you're doing crisis planning, I would play games with this trust. I would make sure that if you're an income cap state, we see the gross income over the income cap amount. We're gonna just, as a rule of process, we're gonna create that qualified income trust. The trustee, once the income trust is created, as we saw in the Kentucky regs, they have to establish a separate bank account in the name of that trust. And then any income in excess of the cap has to be deposited into that account and then distributed by the trustee for allowable expenditures. And again, generally that's going to be right over to the nursing home to pay for their share of costs. Income is still payable to the Medicaid applicant and recipient. So the Medicaid applicant is going to receive their income, then that money is going to transfer to the qualified income trust, and then the trustee of that trust is going to pay the nursing home or, you know, any sort of MMNA shift there. So if you're using a Medicaid compliant annuity, the Medicaid compliant annuity is not payable to the name of the trust. Rather, it's automatically deposited each month into that trust account on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So the money in that case would just go straight to the trust rather than flowing through the institutionalized individual, and that's just a payment issue, but the actual owner of that annuity is not the qualified income trust, but it's the institutionalized individual that would be the owner of that Medicaid compliant annuity. So what are those allowable expenditures? Some states do allow the personal needs allowance to come out of the qualified income trust, obviously not Kentucky. This amount varies from state to state between $30 and $200. This is what my colleague Aaron Kempen refers to as Snickers and haircuts account. It's not a lot. They can get a magazine, maybe. I don't even know what you can buy for $30 these days under those rules, maybe one candy bar at this point. Or the spouse's shift under the MIMNA rules, if they're eligible, that can be an expenditure out of this trust. Certain medical expenses, including supplemental insurance premiums, and then the recipient's copay to the nursing home goes there, and any remaining amount just stays in that trust. So they're very restrictive, and they're only used for Medicaid planning in income cap states. This is not a really great trust. So how does the income flow to this trust? Generally, the income is received and deposited into the QIT account. And then the recipient's allowable expenses are dispersed by the trustee. I love a good graphic. This is great. And then it goes out to the personal needs allowance, medical expenses, the Medicaid copay, and any sort of monthly needs allowance. And remember that the income flow has to be completed within the calendar month the income is received. So for those of you that are visual learners like myself, this is a great graphic to kind of highlight what we've been talking about, the way that these trusts have to work. So what happens when the Medicaid recipient passes away? The state Medicaid agency has the right to recover funds remaining in the trust, and that amount that they can recover does not ever extend beyond the amount of benefits provided on behalf of the recipient. And this is a question that comes up all the time. Well, Jim, you just said that those accounts, that money has to be paid out each and every month. Why would there ever be money left in here? It would happen from time to time. Attorneys have told me there has been money in these accounts when maybe an income payment has come in, the person has passed away, the bill at the nursing home hasn't come due yet, so there's money just kind of sitting in this income trust that would normally be distributed for the nursing home bill, and so that money's sitting there. So sometimes it does happen. It's not very common, but there can be, you know, just some accounting and transfer irregularities that would cause some money to be in that trust. And then the state, you get an account from the Medicaid office, and obviously it's usually going to be more than what they owe that month. And then any money left in that income trust would be paid out and back to the state to satisfy that claim. So when do you set these up? These in most states need to be established prior to submitting a Medicaid application. The Medicaid office generally will review those trusts to make sure that they have all the provisions in those trusts as part of the Medicaid application process and before qualification. Most practitioners will just start depositing any income into that Miller Trust each month once established, so they can show that, hey, yep, we're implementing this trust. We should be otherwise eligible and qualify for Medicaid benefits as quickly as possible. So setting these up before the application, starting to fund them once they're set up, generally is the way that most attorneys go with that. Again, not something that most attorneys want to play with when you're doing crisis Medicaid planning, because our goal is to get help with those nursing home bills as quickly as possible. Some state Medicaid agencies actually have forms that they have available for the qualified income trust. These states are the ones that I could find. There may be others that are out there. These are included in your materials if you follow that link. I pulled those and I put those in the materials. You can see what those forms look like. Again, this is not a very sexy trust. It's not very long. The provisions are very straightforward. The one that I always thought was interesting in how it's written is what happens upon termination. This is from the Ohio form. So let's take a look at how that language is written. It states that upon this trust shall terminate upon the death of the primary beneficiary, at which point the remaining trust property shall be distributed to the Ohio Department of Medicaid or its successor up to the amount equal to the total medical assistance paid on behalf of the primary beneficiary. The trustee is prohibited from repaying other persons or creditors prior to this distribution. Any remaining trust property after the Ohio Department of Medicaid or its successors' claims have been paid shall be distributed to the estate of the primary beneficiary. And again, generally the maximum amount that's going to be kind of stuck in this trust will be 1 month's income amount. So generally that's going to pay off the amount owed to the Medicaid office here, the Ohio Department of Medicaid's claim. So there's really no primary beneficiary at the death of the Medicaid applicant. One issue that I do want to highlight, and this is something that every time I've taught this, I try to drill into attorneys' brains as a great opportunity to get clients back in your office, is make sure that your power of attorneys that you're drafting for your clients that may be getting older and we're giving more authority to the agent under those powers of attorney are properly drafted, and make sure that the client, if they don't have capacity to create a trust, the agent can. Because if there's no power of attorney or spouse available, now we have to go to the court, we have to petition the court, we got to set up a conservatorship or a guardianship to establish the QIT, to then get Medicaid qualification. What are you doing? You're delaying your client's ability to get Medicaid benefits and start the clock on that. So if you aren't putting these powers into your powers of attorney specifically and making sure that you're following your state statutes, that's a great reason to have your clients come back in. Let's redo your power of attorney. As you're getting older, we want to grant maybe some more power over to the agents in case something happens. Let's add in this power. Then we can have a bigger conversation about long-term care planning as well. So this is a great way to get your clients back in your office, update the powers of attorney. And in some states, you really have to follow exact language and execution requirements to give an agent the ability to establish a trust. And I used to work in Florida, and when these came out, this was a big deal. You had to have all your clients come back in to the office and re-execute their powers of attorney if you wanted them to have what they refer to in Florida as superpowers. And they have to be specifically designated and initialed or signed by the principal for the agent to have that power. So in the power of attorney, you have the power, then you have this little dash next to it that the principal has to actually initial each power. And you can see the language there of that they're created. The exercise is not otherwise prohibited by another agreement or instrument to create an inter vivos trust or to create on behalf of the principal, amend, modify, revoke, or terminate the trust, but only if the trust instrument provides for that. So you do need to have these specifically designated powers properly executed in Florida to make sure that your client can actually create that trust on behalf of somebody else. Obviously, we're talking about folks in nursing homes where capacity and elder law is always going to be an issue. Let's make sure that your power of attorney grants the agent the ability to do that. And again, another great opportunity to reach out to your clients that you've done work for before, get them in the office. Let's have a bigger conversation about long-term care planning if they haven't done that. Okay, hopefully everybody could hear me, or I've just been talking into the void for the last 54 minutes. But I think we're ready to take questions, Amy, if you can hear me now.
All right, perfect. Thank you. First question here, what are the responsibilities of a trustee of a QIT?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And this can be a difficult kind of bridge to cross of who am I going to appoint as trustee of this trust? Because with the requirements of the trust, you want to have somebody who is involved in the person's life and is close by, because you want somebody that's going to be around to, you know, get the trust set up, then go to the bank and set up the account, and then make sure that income is coming into this trust each month, and then make sure that the income is going to the nursing home or any sort of shift over to the community spouse is being paid properly. So one thing that you don't want to have is a trustee who might live in another state. You know, we might have a really responsible kid, but if they're not there close by to be able to make sure all of these transactions are happening appropriately, well, the person could lose their Medicaid benefits if the payments aren't being made. Let's say someone goes on vacation and forgets to do this. We need to make sure that we have a trustee close by that can stay on top of it. So generally most people, you know, if they're married, the spouse will do this because they're generally involved. Kids that are close by that are helping out with the care of the parent. If there's no one doing that, you know, you want to find maybe a professional that you could make as a referral to help out to make sure these trusts are being implemented and executed properly. And then obviously when the person passes away, that the Medicaid office is being paid out with those funds.
Perfect. Thank you. Since we are coming up to the top of the hour here, I will take one more question. Any questions that we don't get to today, I will send those over to Jim and he can get back to you on those. But one more for today. Do you have any tips for setting up the bank account that goes with the trust?
Yeah. One thing that we've taught over the years is when your client comes in, find out where their bank is. I wanted to say something snarky about national banks, but I won't. See where the income's coming in and then have the trustee of the QIT set up the trust bank account at the same bank. And then the trustee, what you can do generally is just set up automatic electronic transfers between the accounts within the same bank fairly easily so that, you know, keep the personal needs allowance out and then transfer the rest to the qualified income trust, and then have another electronic transfer from the qualified income trust bank account over to the nursing home each and every month. So that way you kind of remove that element of human error, but start with the client's bank account and then work your way through to the nursing home using electronic transfers. So that can be a tip that an attorney shared with me that I thought was really good and a nice way to set that up. So again, if the trustee wants to go on vacation, they can. And again, I apologize for the technical issues I had at the top. GoToWebinar has its own mind sometimes. So sorry for that. I hope everybody got something out of it. I know I learned a lot about qualified income trusts and it helped me understand where these crazy rules come from sometimes.
Perfect, thank you. Again, if anybody had trouble accessing that Dropbox link that I had sent in the chat, please email marketing@krausfinancial.com and we will get you set up with all of those handouts. A recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you don't already have an account, you can head on over to access.medicaidannuity.com to get started. Signing up is quick, easy, and free and gives you all the access to our latest educational content and long-term care planning resources. Thank you.
And all your numbers. And all your state Medicaid numbers.
I think you said it enough during the presentation, Jim.
Okay. Go to Attorney Access, get your numbers.
All right. Thank you, Jim, for your great presentation. Thank you to everyone for joining us today. And thank you for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon.